massive star dies, it undergoes core collapse supernova and emits copious number of MEV neutrinos. If this happens in our own galaxy, we can detect thousands of neutrino events and will gain incredible information on stellar explosion, neutrino property, and maybe new physics. Of course, fantastic things are harder to get. The expected rate of galactic supernovae is only 2 to 3 per century. The only supernova we've detected neutrinos is supernova 87A, which occurred in LMC 30 years ago. We don't know when the next galactic supernova will happen. Could be tomorrow, could be 50 years from now. So why study it? Well, it is actually the critical time to study supernova neutrino emission. The next galactic supernova will very likely to occur when the next generation neutrino experiments are online. And these neutrino experiments are currently in design and construction stage. So we need to make sure that we know enough about what we're expecting, so when we actually detect neutrinos from next galactic supernova, we won't miss out on crucial information due to inadequate experimental design. So today I'll talk about the neutrino signal from what I call the late times. So here's my overview on supernova neutrino physics. So I show a plot of the new E-bar luminosity as a function of post-bounce time. So post-bounce is a commonly used time axis in supernova study. At the end of stellar burning, a star's iron core will collapse under its own gravity, and then it will keep collapsing and the core density will get higher. When the core density reaches peak, it will bounce back out, and that sets time zero for this post-bounce time. Then the shock will propagate outwards, but then we know it doesn't have enough energy to explode the whole star. So some other physical mechanisms, maybe neutrino heating, will have to dump energy onto the shock, explode the whole star. So typically, this explosion happens at about hundreds of milliseconds for post-bounce time. So in my figure, you see there's a kink there, and that's the explosion in this particular model. So it happens at about 200 milliseconds. So here I grouped the entire supernova neutrino into pre-supernova and main signal. So pre-supernova is before any of these crazy things happen, there's just regular neutrino emission from silicon burning. So it's quite similar to solar neutrino. And you can see that the flux is quite low. So unless the supernova happens quite nearby, like 1 kiloparsec, it's quite difficult to see them. And then I group everything else into what I call main signal. That's really a culture thing. So as I said, the only supernova neutrino was detected are from 87A, where we detect about 20 or so events in a 10-second time window. Somehow this 10-second time window guided our expectation of the duration of a supernova neutrino burst. But if you just look at this figure, an obvious thing to ask is, well, what happens after that? When the next galactic supernova happens, we'll detect thousands of events. Can we not detect anything there? The first goal of my talk is to convince you that indeed we can detect neutrinos from this region. So what do those neutrinos look like? And how can we detect them adequately? That will be the focus of my talk. Due to time limit, I will not have time to go into too much detail on the physics opportunity, but I'm happy to chat about that later. Okay, so this is my motivation slash intro slide. Now let's predict the neutrino signal. So if you want to predict neutrino signal from a supernova, you need to start with a simulation. Now, supernova simulation is a very complicated business on its own. So you might have seen figures like this or videos, very impressive, showing the supernova explosion focusing on the explosion mechanism. But we're interested in 10 seconds, after what happens after 10 seconds, long after the explosion. Remember, explosion happens about 100 milliseconds. So we need to find a code that runs simulation out to this late time. And few people do that. And one of them is our collaborator Luke Roberts at Michigan State. So for the rest of my talk, I'll treat his simulation as a magic box that spits out neutrino emission from supernova and not go into detail. Okay, so let's open the magic box and look at what the neutrino signals look like. So this figure I shows the neutrino luminosity and average temperature, or in this case, actually average energy, as a function of post-bounce time for neutrinos different flavor. So this is where I'll introduce most of the physics, so I'll go over it a bit slowly. So again, my time axis goes from Tobolev's time 1 second to 100 seconds. So this is very different from what you normally see. So 1 to 10 seconds are still in the main signal region, but everything after 10 seconds is new. So in the top figure, I show the luminosity multiplied by t, and this is kind of important because I use a log x-axis because of a large range. So this gives the correct visual integral. So first thing we'll notice is probably that neutrinos of different flavors have quite comparable luminosities. This is, well, hardly surprising because we know that about early time. But next thing you'll probably notice is that t times l is incredibly flat over a large range of time. So this means that for a large range of time, this luminosity drops as a function of 1 over t. Now, this is surprising because for the past 3 decades or so, the most commonly adopted phenomenological model in terms of neutrino luminosity typically has like exponential cutoff. For example, many papers that fit the data from 87A adopt the exponential function. And you see that, well, very far from that. So next thing you'll notice is that there's a super sharp cutoff at about 60 seconds or so. So this is when the star cools, and then the whole star turns transparent to neutrinos, and it's turning into a neutron star. Now, personally to me, this is what I find most exciting about this new signal, because it really connects supernova physics to neutron star physics. Now, if you think about supernova physics, what do you probe with it? Well, explosion mechanism, progenitor structure, and maybe exotic, complicated neutrino mixing phenomena. But all of the effects goes away at this late time. We're just left with a core, and it's cool, it's less dynamic, it's pretty steady. So this region provides a unique opportunity to probe nuclear matter at extreme density and temperature. Now, this environment cannot be reproduced anywhere else, and it cannot be probed by other cosmic messengers, such as gravitational waves or photons. Okay, and on the bottom, I show the average energy of these neutrinos. So the first thing you see is that it decreases pretty steadily over time. So notice that I actually use linear Y scale here, not log. This is as expected because during this whole period, the star just cools. But then if you notice that the difference of the temperature between different species is actually also decreasing. So this has a very nice practical implication. So these are the fluxes straight of the supernova simulation. If you want to predict what they look like in experiments, you need to apply neutrino mixing effect on it. And as we know, in early time, that's really tricky. We're not sure if you're doing it right, and people still argue about that. But at late time, if all the neutrinos have basically the same luminosity and average energy, then the mixing effect will be moderate. So these neutrinos are a very robust probe of the protoneutron star core, without having to worry about whether we're doing the mixing effect correct or not. Okay, so these neutrinos are awesome. How do we see them? So in any neutrino experiment, we're looking for large cross-section with correspondingly with large detector mass. And at MEV, these are the interaction channels mapped onto large detectors. So the first one is inverse beta decay. We all know it very well. This is a golden channel. This is the only channel we've had for 87A. And the largest detector currently running with this channel is SuperK. So that's the detector I consider. More excitingly, DUNE is a proposed next generation neutrino experiment. At a cost of $1 billion, it will be the next generation leading particle program in the US. Now, DUNE is at 10 kiloton scale. So finally, for the first time ever, we have a 10 kiloton scale experiment with a very large cross section that's sensitive to nu E. So that's the detector we consider for new E detection. And in the meantime, Juno is a next generation scintillator experiment that's under construction stage right now. And because of its incredible mass and its scintillator experiment, it can have detect new X on proton scattering. So in our work, we consider the signals in all three detectors. But because of time constraint, I'll only show what happens in SuperK and DUNE for new E bar and new E. If you're interested about Juno, talk to me later. Okay, so how does new E-bar interaction show up in SuperK? So this is the event count per time beam. So for all the following detection figures, I put the supernova at 10 kiloparsec. So that is the average expected distance to the next galactic supernova, and that's also the standard assumption. So nothing weird there. So again, here I used a log time bin, and this is very important, because naively you might plot the event as a function of number per second, where because you're missing a T enhancement, it really makes the signal looks like it's dropping much faster, so it looks harder to detect, and later, and it's really not realistic. So the first thing you see is that after 10 seconds, there is about 260 events in Super K, with the last event comes in at about 60 seconds. Mark, are you checking the math?
Yeah.
Yes. If you add up all the bars, it goes to 260. So I believe for everyone here, 260 sounds like a very large number. And if you need reminder, just remember we've only had about 20 events on supernova 87A. Now, all the way to 60 seconds, this is a much larger time window than what's typically considered in the field. Okay, and another thing that you might worry because I use this large time bin is that the background is going to shoot up at later time. And in fact, that is not the case. For Super K above 3.5 MeV, the expected background rate in 1 minute is less than one. So this is really a 1 minute background-free detection window with extra 260 events that people have not considered before. Awesome. So how do these events look like in Super K? So for inverse beta decay, you detect this positron energy. So here I show the positron energy spectrum integrated in four large time bins, again, equal log time bin. So the first thing you see is something that we've talked about. As time goes on, generally the spectrums are getting softer, so other lines are moving towards my right. And as luminosity is decreasing, so other lines are going down. But importantly, you see the detection threshold is indicated by this dashed line at 3.5 MeV, which is quite a conservative estimate. These neutrinos are not too soft. So the threshold is low enough that you are still able to sample most of the spectrum. And because of this nice energy relation between this positron energy and neutrino energy, just looking at this, you know that you get a quite decent reconstruction of neutrino spectrum. So not only can we detect 260 events at late time, we can also get a quite good energy estimate on them. Okay, so to sum up the situation in Super K, which is currently running, if a supernova goes off tomorrow, we'll detect extra 260 events that people had not previously considered, and we'll detect them quite nicely. Okay, so how does the situation look like in Dune? So here's in Dune charge current interaction. So the figure is made in similar way at Super K. And to first order, you see that it looks quite similar, the shape looks quite similar. And the overall normalization is slightly lower, about 70 events after 10 seconds, with the last one comes in about 40 or 50 seconds. Now, in this case, this 40 or 50 seconds is actually a very important number. And the reason is that, as I said, Dune is in design stage right now. It is quite challenging for Dune to continuously read out data and to save them. So right now, people are proposing, people are working on DAQ in Dune that will continuously read out data for about 10 seconds. And they're aiming for this goal because of, well, galactic neutrino burst, which 10 seconds sounds already is quite challenging. However, if that's our goal, looking at this figure, you know that, well, 10 seconds is really not enough. So we really should need to aim for DAQ that's on the order of 1 minute to actually record all the data. So that's one point that we want to convey with this study. Okay, so how do these neutrinos, how do these electrons look like in Dune? Again, this is the time integrated spectrum of this electron. Again, to first order, that looks quite similar to what happens in Super K. But the point I want to draw on this slide is completely different. So it just, all the difference is in the numbers. So first, because it was in design stage, again, we do not know what detection threshold they can hit. So 5 MeV is a very optimistic design goal. So if the threshold is at 5 MeV, as I indicated here, then the situation will be quite similar to super gain. You're still able to sample most of the spectrum, so at least you know you cover the peak, so you're able to reconstruct neutrino spectrum quite well. However, 5 MeV is quite challenging to reach. A very likely outcome could be a 10 MeV threshold. So imagine you put a threshold at 10 MeV, and ignore after 10 seconds, even between 1 and 10 seconds, you realize that you're only sampling half of the spectrum, barely making or missing the peak, in which case you cannot even reconstruct well, say, the average energy of the neutrino. And in later time, even though you can detect events, you're only sampling really a tail of the spectrum. So what information you can extract given a 10 MeV threshold is uncertain. So that's another goal that we want to convey with the study, is that if we want to get decent information on the neutrino energy, for Dune, really a 5 MeV threshold is needed. And if you wonder why the situation is quite different in Dune, so first, super gain threshold is 3.5 and Dune is 10, that sounds very different. Another difference is that notice for this charge current channel, this electron energy is quite different from neutrino energy. So there, just because of interaction, you're losing 6 MeV in neutrino versus deposit energy, whereas for inverse beta decay, that difference is only 1.3 MeV. So this is what's hurting you, and the threshold. Okay, so yes.
So this threshold is just a matter of how much you want to spend collecting the same signal. Because there's a lot of argon produces much more information as a target than water. The amount of charge, the amount of light. I don't even know what the current design of Dune is. Is it only a charge readout?
Oh, so the main thing is wire plane. So people are arguing about at 5 MeV, so that sets the threshold for 5 MeV, because depends on the wire spacing. You need the track to at least cross, you know, two wires, right? So that's one way of thinking about the threshold. But then people also argue about like adding some photosensors around the detector, where maybe at these super low energies, you're able to use the light to reconstruct the energy. And depends on which one might work better, it's uncertain. And how many photo coverage you will get is uncertain.
Okay, so they haven't settled on the design yet?
No. It's still in design stage. That's, yeah.
What's the charge current threshold energy though?
So that's the detection. So, okay, so if you, for this charge current interaction, if you go to ground state potassium, then it's only 1.5, I think. Right. However, the ground state potassium interaction is forbidden, so this is the first super allowed state. So you can't do anything there. So that excited potassium has like 4.4 MeV energy. So then they also talk about whether you can tag that gamma, but you know it's challenging. It's not certain. Okay. So to sum up the situation in super gain and Dune, for super gain detection prospect looks quite nice. For Dune, we probably need to push for the design requirement, and it could be quite nice. However, for both cases, what I consider is a neutrino emission out of a supernova simulation, where you have a successful explosion and you look at the core, you look at the cooling of the stellar core. That doesn't have to be the case. So we also consider a very important alternative outcome, where you form a black hole. So there are generally two scenarios where you can form a black hole. First is case two called failed supernova. What happens is, again, after core bounce, you have a shock going out, and the shock does not have enough energy to explode the whole star, so at this time, it can just fail and form a black hole. So typically, this happens at early time, hundreds of milliseconds, up to a couple seconds. So this is a more well-known case. In this case, you do not have an optical supernova counterpart later. Another case, it could be that, so this whole explosion happens, your successful things get blown out, you're left with a stellar core. But this core can have quite soft equation of state. Then later on, depends on what's the equation of state you assume, it can just collapse on its own. And that's my case three, called metastable protoneutron star. So depends on what equation of state you assume, this can happen anywhere between, say, a few seconds to tens of seconds. So obvious question to ask is, given that there's a large time range where a black hole can form, how well can we detect it? So this figure shows the answer. So what I plotted is, on the left y-axis, is the number of interactions that you would detect, you would expect after a certain time. So at early time, imagine that you're getting hundreds of events in 1 second, and suddenly, boom, you get nothing. So obviously, you detect a black hole. It can get tricky once you're entering this 30 seconds, 40 seconds time regime where you're getting a few events in a 10-second time window, and the next 10 seconds, you get nothing. Is it due to Poisson fluctuation, or is it black hole? So on the right, I plotted what's the detection significance you can get if that time is the when you detect last event. So it's basically the Poisson fluctuation of the left number goes to zero. So we can see that, you know, we actually do quite well. So in early time, like the failed supernova case, detection is 40 sigma. It doesn't mean it's just very high. But we can actually detect a black hole formation all the way to 40 seconds. Now, this is quite nice. It just means, in principle, we can exclude all the equation state that predict a collapse of proto-neutron star all the way anywhere before 40 seconds, if this happens. Okay, so this is what you should remember from my talk. The next galactic supernova will happen. Now is the time to study it. We're undertaking a series of studies that aim to draw attention to what we call late time, everything after 10 seconds. So we're hoping that more theorists would start simulate these emissions, and we're hoping experimentalists would adjust the timescale they have in timescale of 10 seconds that they had in their mind all the way to 1 minute when they design their experiments. That's all. Thank you.
The black curve is what people are using beforehand, and you guys are using the green blue curve, is that correct? And where did those come from? And are you learning something about the neutron star interior when you make this measurement?
Sorry, I didn't even explain the black. I forgot the black curve is there. Okay, so the different color lines are just different flavors. And the black curve is my fit. So I was trying to fit the corner. So it's just a one over t and with a super exponential. That's basically exponential t to the second, t squared or something. So what phenomenological models people that typically use is actually exponential cutoff, which you would imagine it just looks completely different, which I did not draw here. So for example, commonly, you see a lot of paper fitting 87A data where the luminosity is just exponential with a scale of 10 seconds, 8 seconds, stuff like that. So that would just cut it up. If it's exponential, you will get anything after 10 seconds, right? Right, another question is what we can learn. So that's what I just did not go into at all in my talk. For example, one thing is this transparency, so when does this corner turn? It's called transparency time. So this transparency time, for example, depends on the mass of the proto-neutron star core. So by measuring where, and some other things, but that's one main dependence. So by measuring where this thing happens, it can tell you something about the mass of the stellar core, where if you only go to 10 seconds, you just will not see that at all, right? So that's one thing. And there are a lot of other things you can do. For example, by comparing the new E bar versus new E, by adding super gain dune, you take into account luminosity as well as temperature, you can measure the number difference between new E and new E bar, which tells you something about deleptonization, right? And that's really a continuous process. So if you want to figure out what's the total number difference, stopping at 10 just really wouldn't do it. And
if you refit supernova 1987A with a different, not an exponential, but something that you think is more realistic, then does it change any of the conclusions that people make about the energy?
Yeah, my question.
Was that your question?
Yeah, exactly.
Coherent question.
Okay, awesome. I don't think it would change. Well, so I think for 87A, the error bar on the energy is quite large, right? And it's only in UE bar, so people typically just multiply it by 6 to get the total energy. I think given the uncertainties, it would not change much.
The energetic is quite fixed.
Well, we know the energetic is a problem with the inventory. And this seems that it was in every industry of conservation. Now, if you change from exploration to this flat behavior, I wonder how can you agree with conservation?
Okay, so you're saying that by fitting an exponential, we've got the total energy that's roughly right in the ballpark.
So the energy, theoretically, you know,
correct.
Good precision. Then imagine that you take an exponential decrease with a time scale of 10 seconds, which, right. As you say, is probably what has been done for supernova.
Right.
And this seems to agree with the relation. Now, if you change this effect up to 60 seconds, I wonder what that is.
Correct. That's a very good question. So the answer to that is, in terms of, so how much this, so this basically, this energy is a fraction of the total exposure energy. So this is after 1 second, where for this model, the explosion happens at 200 milliseconds. So there's a large luminosity that's come from accretion, right? That's much, much higher than this cooling stage. So if you look at the time integral of the luminosity of a supernova, there's a lot of stuff coming out before explosion and accretion time. So this, everything after that is already a fraction of that. And basically, by extending this from 10 seconds to, you know, 60 seconds, and remember, you're doing the integral by eye. You're at most adding 50% of this late time luminosity. So this does not affect the total luminosity all that much, because I do not plot anything before 1 second.
Also, flat is not flat. It's really 1/T.
Yeah. Okay, I can see T times luminosity.
This is in reasonable accord with the 87A data. We're working on that.
Just to check that my understanding is right, the uncertainty for oscillation parameters is biggest at early time, so at late time that doesn't really help. The two experiments that you studied, why those two? I mean, there's running experiments as well. You're not worried about those?
So you mean why did I pick SuperK and Dune?
Right.
Well, for inverse beta decay, SuperK is the largest one.
Sure.
Except for IceCube, but that's a separate. And for new E, Dune is really the, in terms of large cross-section as well as large detector mass, Dune is really the game in town, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just always freaking out when we come to supernova that I always think it blows up tomorrow. And so, you know, I mean, the statement that you make is a correct one, and I think everybody that has an experiment should know that, right? So, I mean, you know, you wouldn't want, whatever, pick LED, you wouldn't want Boric Xenon not to know that. Today, right? I mean.
Yes, correct. So this is just example detectors that we use. Okay. Certainly by no means we're trying to say we're only targeting SuperK and Dune, and everyone else just should not look at data after 10 seconds. That's by no means what I'm saying.
Most of the other detectors are just smaller versions of these.
Well, yeah, but so then it depends on you. Okay, because you multiply by T, right? That's a very nice trick, right? I mean, if you don't do that, your background goes up, and so your background rate depends on how fast you go up. Yeah. Meaning, even if you are sensitive to the same neutrino detection channel, where you cross over, that your background kills your signal at long times can be different for different detectors. So it's actually not clear that just because you have a bigger detector, you are better for late times, because it might be that in a smaller detector you have less backgrounds.
So, right, that's a good point, but really for example, certainly for SuperK and Dune, if you consider 1 minute time window and the energy threshold that we consider, it's really background free. Now we're investigating how far this time scale can go given different models. So I think in the ballpark, this transparency time would definitely not go over like 200 seconds or something. Where certainly, I think the statement is still true in SuperK and Dune, where the background rate is just less than one.
you still need to feed hundreds of tons to see anything.
This is 2.5 kiloton. This is the highest cross section. And you have 260 events. You have to be able to, you know, 100 tons is one event.
So we should comment on the other detectors. We'll do that. That's a good point.
Well, if it's background freeze, one event that you have.
No, you have one event.
I mean, as you say, if you have different models, like a black hole formation that cuts off this slow tail later at earlier times, but your zero background experiment has this one event at a later time.
It's a good point, actually, that if you wait for 500 seconds, like, you can see one or two events, is that informative or not? Yeah, it looks bad if I'm not going to freeze up to 500 seconds. Very, very late. Is that interesting?
I mean, in dark matter, we have this thing where you always say, if you see just one recoil, right, what do you learn? But you see something, because this one recoil gives you one recoil energy that directly gives you a minimum velocity of the particle, which is, you know, something. It's not a trivial piece of information. And in this case, if you just go with a moment for, you know, you say a background free measurement, and you have one event, that doesn't give you a spectrum, but it tells you that your supernova is still active at that time.
It's worth asking your question before.
Also, I guess I agree with you. I mean, you could actually maybe add multiple 100-ton experiments, and then you have five events and tell you a bunch more. But, you know, 1 ton, I don't think you're going to see anything like that.
Nobody has 1 ton.
Don't you have 1 ton?
Well, but after you're about 100.
Well, no, the cross section is about the same, no?
No, I get a vector after. My detector is 100 tons. Yes. I 100 tons equivalent. Actually, 200 tons because it's 2.5. I'm on that map. I can see it then, and I have no background as well. So yes, I'll talk to our guys tomorrow. We'll reprogram our trigger.
Good. That's good.
Go ahead, John.
Because you're talking about
Sure.
So
backgrounds is actually an entirely different discussion that we once started, but we didn't pick it up again, and that is. I mean, all those experiments, from what I know, measure their backgrounds, right? And that's, of course, dangerous, because if there's a supernova happening, then you get all kinds of spallation crap that can do all kinds of things, which I don't know does what in terms of background. So I'm actually not sure whether any of them particular.
What do you mean by that? So when a supernova happens, why do you get spallation crap?
You have neutrinos in the rock, and they give you a hadronic shower that goes into your detector, and then you have a neutron that gets absorbed by something which decays with a short half-life of a few seconds, and that blows up you. And there, I mean, you know, you don't need a lot of events, right?
So Rafael, one thing, you're not 100 tons, because also the number density matters. So 1 ton of protons is 10 times more targets than 100 tons of xenon. So it's certainly on that factor.
So I say it again.
1 ton of protons, the number of targets, is 100 times more than 1 ton of xenon. So the number density comes into play for targets.
A squared over A.
Yeah, so it's A at most. And I think
that's what I'm saying, I have a factor 100.
Why?
Well, because my A is 100.
Yeah, right.
But we don't have protons, we have oxygen. Oxygen is giving the mass, protons are the targets.
Sure.
Okay.
So I think you have spallation crap, right? You have, these are tens of MeV events, but you're not going to get hadronic coming out of the rock. There might be some neutrons.
Sure.
Yeah, those get shielded in the MeV model. The big neutrino types get shielded. The dark matter experiments also support shielding them.
That one is fine. So I just want to comment that there's a couple of physics opportunities here that some of the people here may find appealing, things that have not been worked on. So one thing that this opens up is the possibility of testing anomalous cooling of a hot neutron star by emission of light dark matter, lightning particles that are not neutrinos, et cetera, et cetera. So if there's an opportunity to measure the neutron star cooling at late times, there's an opportunity to test new energy loss channels. That's one opportunity. Another opportunity that I have all wanted to explore but I've never been able to do, so you can steal it freely, is what if the supernova, the pre-supernova star, has a bunch of WIMPs in it through ordinary WIMP capture and all of that? What happens to all of those WIMPs when the core collapses? Now, one possibility is that the width distribution is very small because the dark matter mass is high, then it all gets crushed down inside the neutron star, either dragged in by scattering with the matter, or because it's already there, or by the adiabatic contraction of the gravitational potential. And then you can get a huge increase in the annihilation rate. It's interesting to ask if that could affect the neutron star energy. Calculation that Hooper and I made 15 years ago looks like not very much, so we give it up. But there's an interesting idea, but I just thought of right now, is first is that if the neutron star gets a kick, it might leave that cluster of dark matter behind, and then all of a sudden you might have a neutron star over here, and then here's a very tightly compacted distribution of dark matter that used to be this big, and then when the core collapsed, it got this big, and now it's annihilating like crazy, and it's sending out unshielded gammas and neutrinos that can escape and be more detectable. That's not totally crazy. So
just to follow up on this, though, there was a paper on, I think, exactly that topic by Joachim and Frank.
Yeah, so the Kopp and Bernard paper got in that neighborhood, but I think has not fully exploited the opportunities, in particular the thing I just mentioned about kids. So you have a dark matter distribution, you compact the hell out of it, and then you move the compactor, and now it's unshielded canvas. Maybe that may be fun.
Would it stay compact? Is it
I don't know. I haven't given it any more thought than this. So the time I was talking, that was the time I was thinking. One of the best things is if the dark matter mass is light, the initial distribution is quite large in space, and some of it may be outside of the compacted neutron star, but it may be pulled in by gravitational contraction, and that may also be. So that's a bunch of random ideas to see this wishes. I'm not saying they're any good. I'm just saying that the late time observations give you a chance to look for new things.
It's a tiny amount of dark matter that, if you've got self-annihilating dark matter, that the amount of dark matter in any star is really, really tiny. So
it is.
10 to 10 tons or something like that.
It's not much, but if it were shielded, it may be more interesting. Okay.
The question is whether.
Thank you.